Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. Governor Sununu says he's more than met his promise to court 100 businesses in his first 100 days. The debate over full-day kindergarten picks up steam in the New Hampshire House. The New Hampshire Senate votes to regulate fantasy sports but leave Bitcoin alone. Owen LaBrie is denied a new trial, and President Trump picks Scott Brown to be his New Zealand ambassador. Good morning, all. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers, joined this week by Dave Solomon, New Hampshire Union leader, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, and Kathleen Ronan of the Associated Press. It has been a big week for Governor Sununu, news on several fronts. Why don't we start with something the governor did yesterday, which was report back on his campaign promise, oft repeated, to personally recruit 100 businesses in 100 days. Kathleen and Dave, you were both there. The governor's obviously feeling good about how these trips have gone, but did we learn much other than his good feeling?
So we found out that the governor has visited or met with, I guess not visited, some of them are phone calls, video conferences, et cetera, 127 businesses, and he says 23 states and 7 countries. But we still, you know, he gave a press conference. He was unable to name a single business that will actually be coming to New Hampshire. He said he's very confident and got some firm commitments, but he said that he got no hard commitments. So I'm not really sure the difference between hard and firm there. But he also said that it would be premature to say how many companies will be moving to New Hampshire, but, you know, expressed high confidence that we'd be seeing some.
Yeah, he did. And you know, David, he's talked about this in the context of being, you know, more or less an evangelist for New Hampshire's business climate, that, you know, we can return to what we once were. Why don't we take a listen to what he said? It's interesting to hear.
I am a firm believer that we have not truly tapped in to the potential that we have, that we once had, in being a real, not just a driver of the economy, but known as a place to land your business, known as a place to land your career when we talk about workforce. We have to be on the forefront of people's minds. The best way to do that is to get out there and do it the New Hampshire way. You talk to people one-on-one. You sit with them one-on-one in their offices or in the governor's office. You can talk with them on the phone, whatever it might be. But making that direct connection can make all the difference in the world in terms of either retaining or bringing business to New Hampshire.
Okay, so he talks about getting back to what we once were. David, is that feasible?
Well, he also makes it sound like he was on some kind of a whirlwind tour of 7 countries and 23 states. You'll notice in the comments he makes it a point to make reference to, or on the phone, or in the governor's office, or by webinar, which apparently is how 20 of these were accounted for. In fact, the only international travel involved in this was one trip to Canada. So the other 6 countries were largely by telephone or some other telecommunications, as probably were the other 23 states, because the travel itself only involved New England. So he can, as governor, make a great visual and a thematic approach to business and try to recreate many of the conditions in the past. But New Hampshire's draw to business in the past had a lot to do with the manufacturing economy, the growth of the high-tech industry, the migration of people from Massachusetts here in the 80s and before that to start businesses. A lot of those dynamics don't exist anymore. So recreating the past is not the way to attract new business. Yeah, I think he's going to have to work with the dynamics that exist today.
Yeah, like Kathleen, I was pondering the difference between a firm commitment and a hard commitment. I guess there's some implication there about
salesman. No.
Okay. Right. So, you know, I understand the reasons for confidentiality. This issue of poaching businesses between states is a time-honored tradition. And as soon as, you know, the state that hosts the business gets wind of things, then you start to have discussions about tax breaks and things like that in the home state. So on the one hand, I understand why he's not going to necessarily name any companies. And, you know, I do think, as Dave was saying, there is kind of sort of a nice kind of campaign-y feel to this sort of thematic approach. But, you know, in the end, he's going to be judged by, you know, companies actually moving here. And cool. So in 2 years, when he, assuming he runs for re-election, that will be a question. Okay, of these 127 businesses, who has actually showed up?
Kathleen?
Yeah, and I was just going to say one interesting comment that he made. He said that he was talking to, I think, some type of software company in New Hampshire who said, well, why are you going out and trying to recruit all these businesses when I can't even find workers? And he said, well, you know, we shouldn't fear competition. But I think that it's been interesting to see that the approach is solely focused on business recruitment, and it's not been coupled with some type of more comprehensive workforce development initiative. Certainly, workforce development is something that is a focus in the state. There's been legislation going through. I know it's something that the governor has talked about, but to hear him kind of admit that a business in New Hampshire as well was saying, well, I'm already struggling to find workers. Who's going to work for all these new businesses, I thought was sort of an unexplored dynamic of this whole thing that, we, you know, we want to bring all these businesses in, but
do we actually have
the workers?
If you look at the report, you know, such as it is that he issued, I mean, a lot of it is, you know, a restatement of policies he supported on the campaign trail, in the sense that we need to, it's going to take some time, but if we create the proper climate, you know, kindergarten is now part of that, you know, some right to work, something that has sort of failed and been taken off the table of, you know, for at least another year, was part of that, that if we build the New Hampshire that can be, you know, essentially a fertile ground for businesses to land and develop, so much the better. And you know, why don't we, before we move off this, so why don't we listen to what he said on the confidentiality point? I thought that that was interesting.
Look, if you're a manufacturer in Pennsylvania or wherever, and you're looking to pick up and move 100 employees, that is not something necessarily you want to publicize. It doesn't mean they're coming here. They could come to a lot of different locations. The fact that they're looking creates problems for them. This is a request of those businesses. This isn't our stipulation. It is a request of those businesses that we keep things confidential until such time that they're ready to talk and promote it. So,
all right, that was the governor talking about why he's not going to be divulging any of the companies he visited with or contacted. And you can certainly understand the practical implications of that. I will say, from a straight right to know point of view, the way he put that was interesting to me, because he's basically saying we can't share the info, not because he wouldn't want to potentially, but because the companies don't want to. And I'm not sure, you know, under statute and the Constitution, whether the company's concerns are necessarily privileged.
Right. There's no legal requirement on either side for this information to be disclosed. It's hard to imagine, out of 127 companies, there's not 5 to 10 whose move or interest in the state is not so imminent that we couldn't learn of a few of these contacts that have been made.
And you know, he said that, you know, that he believes that there will be companies moving here. I mean, as governor-elect, you know, we may recall when he claimed, it was at a speech in Bedford I was at, that GE was wanted to move to New Hampshire and didn't do so because New Hampshire, you know, essentially failed to make the sale. You know, he said that we sent bureaucrats and we should have sent business people. You know, we did some reporting on this, and it was hard to find anyone who shares the governor's view. There were, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of tax incentives and GE's stated desire to be, you know, in a city. Kathleen.
Well, just, I guess, an interesting point on that, though. It's not, you know, when Governor Hassan and whoever was out there actively recruiting GE, it's not like they were walking the New Hampshire public through every step of the process. It's not like they were telling us, well, we're going to meet with GE now and we're doing this and we're doing that. So that kind of goes, I think, somewhat to the confidentiality point. That it's not like Sununu's unique in saying, I'm trying to recruit businesses, but I'm not going to.
Well, he certainly put it front and center, and that's something you might expect from a Republican when Governor Benson was in. I mean, he made a big deal out of saying, if any company wants to locate to New Hampshire, I personally will get on the phone with them within 24 hours. And That has been an emphasis. And obviously, Governor Benson was somebody who moved his company here.
Well, and it's true that there are legitimate complications that arise when companies are looking to move. I think there's some truth to that. You know, but the political issue here also as well is that, you know, he's getting and will continue to get pushback from Democrats who say, you know, this is essentially kind of a publicity stunt. And until you show some actual results, how do we really know what you've actually done if you're going to keep this all confidential? So he's got, you know, sort of the legal and business issues on one side, but there is also this political context as well that I'm seeing out there among Democrats and opponents of the governor.
One last point on this. We were, Dean and I were both at a business and industry association conference last week, and I spoke to some businesses there, and they said that if the governor wants to attract new business here, the best thing he can do is deal with energy prices and the workforce issues in addition to aggressive recruiting.
This is what Kathleen was saying.
And the workforce initiative has been fairly limp because they have a very pretty aggressive workforce program, but they attached it to a bill to tighten up food stamp restrictions, which means
we're going to get to that in the morning. But I mean, the second point, I mean, energy prices, obviously that's a snap to fix those, isn't it, David?
No, that's the trouble. It's easy to go out and or say I've talked to 127 businesses, but to deal with the energy and workforce issues on the ground is the far greater challenge.
Tell us what you think. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Listening to the governor talk about his experiences recruiting this business, it has given him a fresh way to, you know, sort of pitch policy goals, though. And that you could certainly see that flowing into the debate this week on kindergarten as the governor's proposal was taken up by the House Education Committee. He said that it came up in Canada. He said people in Quebec are talking about New Hampshire and its absence of kindergarten. Kathleen, you were in the hearing this week. What did you take away from that? Do you think that the kindergarten bill really has new life in the House?
I think that it might. I mean, no one asked the governor, you know, direct questions about it. He kind of breezed in, did his 10-15 minute spiel and breezed out. But I think just looking, I mean, if you were to gauge kind of by looking at the committee members, right, there seemed to be a decent amount of enthusiasm from some Republicans. You know, the committee chairman, Rick Ladd, looked like he was, you know, very engaged with what the governor had to say. Other Republicans that we know are against it, you know, looked like they didn't really care that much what was going on. But I think, they have Democrats on this, right? So they're going to need, 30, 40 Republicans to make this happen. And I definitely don't think that that is out of the realm of possibility, especially given, some of the headlines, I think, that have come out about the House's ineffectiveness, the governor's ineffectiveness in dealing with the House. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, Republicans and the governor are starting to say, okay, let's get a win here. Let's get something that we can come together on.
I mean, it's interesting because certainly Speaker Jasper has been quite public about his skepticism about state support for full-day kindergarten, says it should be a local decision, has said it's about socialization, not education. This is an area where he and, you know, his fiercest critics in the House, the sort of Freedom Caucus, sort of Liberty Wing types, they're in agreement on that. Whether leadership chooses to get involved in this is unclear. I mean, obviously, the committee is going to vote on the bill next week. And
I don't know this for sure, but it would be very surprising to me if leadership were to aggressively come out against the governor on this. That's just not something that you see happen. I mean, even on Right to Work, you know, Jasper knew that it wasn't going to happen, but he didn't come straight out while it was going on and kind of attack the governor on it. And I think that he has said, you know, we're going to deal with kindergarten in a different bill. And when not in the budget, when he says that, he doesn't say, and we're going to be opposing the governor. So I think it would be quite unique and quite the good political story if you have the House Speaker not sitting back, but actively, you know, campaigning against something that the governor wants.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned that Democrats are going to be supportive of this. Why don't we take a listen to what Democratic Senator David Waters had to say. He was the author of the original kindergarten bill that the Senate amended to mirror what Governor Sununu wanted. His bill would have spent more money, would have allocated money, on a straight per pupil basis. Why don't we listen to what Senator Waters said?
I fully and strongly support the governor's plan. It is a New Hampshire plan. It is a pragmatic approach and a next step in a long journey since 1999 to provide kindergarten education for the children of New Hampshire.
All right, that was Senator David Waters, Democrat from Dover. He sat at the at the table testifying, you know, kind of hip to hip with Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley. It was a real kind of like, here we are, bipartisan. You know, that's been a tougher thing to achieve in the House most of the time. I mean, David, do you see this?
This is really going to be a sort of a indication of the future need for Republican and Democrats to come together on big bills to get them done. If full-day kindergarten passes, it'll be the first major legislation to clear, if you don't count parental notification for sex education and concealed carry, and it will have gone through on a bipartisan basis. And with the divisions in the Republican Party now, it's becoming apparent that a lot of major initiatives are not going to pass strictly along party lines, at least not in the House.
And this is the kind of issue where if the governor really puts some political capital behind it, he can frame it as this bipartisan success. And it's a generational issue, as we know. And so I think there's an opportunity for him here on a fairly, not necessarily small, but a fairly targeted issue to build up some political capital as a result. It's, you know, the kind of issue that Democrats have been talking about it for a while, so he could take advantage of that.
Well, and certainly you can expect it to be front and center in his reelection effort, when we get there.
I mean, he recalls, I'm sure, that one of the lasting memories about Governor Jean Shaheen is that she brought half-day kindergarten to the state, and he wants a legacy like that for himself, for the other half, I guess.
And, you know, one thing that's another interesting thing, the way this debate has changed, is that a lot of the debate has not simply been about, you know, what may be good for students, and whether that's a tactical thing, because some House Republicans clearly believe that a full-day kindergarten may not be good for students, that it may be too much, that the educational gains may be lost. There's lots of citing of certain studies that indicate that. It was interesting to hear Mayor Gatsis come in and talk about it as a way to sort of blunt the effects of the opioid crisis, that you know, youngsters born into families where drugs are an issue need a way to kind of catch up and a place to learn. You've got New Futures pushing it. You have the BIA is now throwing its support.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost as though the possibility for success in getting this increases to the extent that they can bring in other arguments about kind of attracting businesses with kindergarten or helping families with opioid dependence, not simply a debate about the extent to which cognitive benefits of kindergarten extend out over a couple years or not. So I think that the more arguments they can bring in, you can get in buy-in from Republicans on some of the business aspects and get Democrats who already support it to buy in for some of the other arguments.
Well, I do think the vote on the committee is going to be interesting to watch, because it was quite apparent sitting in that committee is that in a lot of House committees you have people with real points of view on the issues that you'd expect, that you know, more or less hew to their parties, but you know, particularly on issues like education, you have seemingly like half the committee with people who have like a sort of a foot in the education world professionally or had sat on school boards, and then you have half who are very much people who are skeptical of bureaucratic approaches to education, in their estimation, very critical of anything but strict local control. And so it's hard when you're looking at the committee to necessarily see much of a middle ground.
Well, however it comes out of committee, with the right combination of Democrats and Republicans, the votes are certainly going to be there in the House. So I don't know that the committee vote is going to be that critical.
All right.
Well, I mean, if they ITL it, you got to flip the ITL to vote it not to pass. But I agree with Dave. I mean, I think they can, if Sununu should be able to have the political capital to get 30 to 40 Republicans to stand with him on this.
All right. Tell us what you think. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. We have an email in from Wayne from Romney. Talking about the governor's recruitment efforts, he says good jobs are grown right here by creating an environment in which homegrown businesses can flourish. Poaching businesses from other states is expensive and ineffective. So says Wayne in Romney. Tell us what you think. The exchange email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, join the sweep by Dave Solomon, New Hampshire Union Leader, Dean Spilios, Southern New Hampshire University, Kathleen Ronan, Associated Press. You can also check us out on Facebook Live. Coming up after a break, more of the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the exchange in just a moment. I'm Josh Rogers. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Why don't we go to the phones? Mary's on the line with from Tamworth. Good morning, Mary. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that the attempt to try to get businesses into New Hampshire is utterly futile unless we improve our school system. And expanding kindergarten is a good idea, but it's not enough. And this Republican proposal to have vouchers for students so they have so-called freedom of choice, which is really a sneaky way of giving a gift to the religious schools, it's just a mad idea, and it will just bring down our education system even more in New Hampshire. I know.
All right, Mary, loud and clear. We're going to get to that in a minute. Thank you for calling. All right. One person who's sort of deeply involved in education policy who was making some news this week as well was Commissioner Frank Edelblue, like Governor Sununu, an avowed champion of school choice. He had a plan to reorganize the Department of Education, hit a bit of a speed bump this week. David, you wrote about this. What's going on there?
Frank Edelblue has just come out with all guns blazing. I mean, he is obviously not going to take a careful and methodical approach to this new appointment as Education Commissioner, even though it was surrounded by considerable opposition. Particularly among the education establishment, if you will. He comes in at one of his first board meetings, attempts to reverse the science standards that the board had approved only a year earlier, and then the week later, through the legislative offices of Senator John Reagan, proposes an amendment that would essentially give him authority to wipe the slate clean as regards the way the State Department of Education is organized, what its four divisions are called, what they do, what the qualifications should be for the people that run them, whether there should be an assistant commissioner, and if so, what that person should do and what that person's qualification should be. Now, he's not suggesting removing the incumbents who are running those four divisions now. In fact, he speaks highly of those individuals. But the notion that he wants the legislature to give him a blank sheet of paper upon which he can now redesign the education department was greeted with some considerable alarm in the general educational community. And there was some considerable pushback in the Senate, where it was in the House, rather, where it was voted down in committee. Well, and in fact, they voted to retain it, keep it in committee.
Well, I mean,
so in effect, they're going to sit on it.
Commissioner Edelblue says that what he was envisioning was not as sweeping or broad as, you know, critics say, and that it is looking to kind of harmonize what actually happens at the Department of Education with its underlying laws. You know, certainly people close to the governor who I spoke with said that, you know, they're certainly sympathetic with what Edelblue was trying to do, but were kind of rolling their eyes a bit, you know, at the way he tried to achieve it. I mean, MUR reported that he first approached the House Finance Committee and was told this is too sweeping a change to do without a public hearing. He then went to Senator Reagan, who's the chair of the Education Committee in the state Senate. Reagan agreed to do it. He told NHPR that he agreed to do this because Edelblue told him he was facing internal resistance within the Department of Education. When we talked to Edelblue, Edelblue said, oh, no, this is all just to harmonize and bring reality into fidelity with underlying laws. You know, this is now going to be heard. Parts of this are going to be heard. I mean, Senator Waters has introduced an amendment that will be heard in the Education Committee in the Senate that will give Edelblue potentially some of what he wants, but, you know, retain more for study.
Well, Waters is trying to find a compromise that will give Edelblue the authority to make some of these changes, only with greater consultation with the Board of Education and the legislature. But what his real preference is another amendment that would simply create a study committee that would examine the new commissioner's concerns and work with him to plot a course of action. That's really the outcome he's hoping for, whether the middle ground that says some reorganization is necessary, but you'll need to share authority in how to do it, is probably the more likely outcome.
The politics of this is fascinating. We know that Frank Edelblue's appointment to the department was controversial. people who are advocates for public school education in the state were very concerned that, you know, he comes from a conservative perspective. He homeschooled his own kids. And so their concerns was that he would kind of work in ways in the department that are antithetical to the public schools in the state. And, you know, he had initially kind of told people, you know, he's there to be an advocate for public schools and not to be so concerned. But you look at what he's actually doing and you see the reorganization attempt. You see these freedom savings accounts. You see an attempt to rethink some of the science standards, the State Board of Ed. And that's exactly the kind of stuff that
I think when
public school advocates point to and say
using state money for schools.
Sounds like we're listening to him right now.
Go ahead, Dean.
Okay. So in any event, so this has turned out to be quite controversial, and you know, people who opposed Edelblue as a commissioner of the department point to these three, four immediate examples of exactly the kinds of things that they expected from him and why they opposed his nomination. And, you know, stuff will be continued to be debated and there may be compromises, but there's no doubt that he is looking to move the department in a particular direction.
Well, and Governor Sununu is certainly looking to move the discussion on education
sure.
along. I mean, you look at his,
yeah.
you could argue education is the place where the most is happening. He replaced Tom Raffio. He didn't reappoint Tom Raffio to be chairman of the State Board of Education, a decision that, you know, Raffio was quick to say will harm the board's operations. He replaced him with Drew Klein, you know, someone we all know, former editorial page writer for the Union Leader. Sununu has now appointed three members of the Board of Education. We have the school choice bills that have been invoked by our caller and also by you, Dean. Why don't we listen to what Governor Sununu said about these bills this week? I think it's interesting.
I think when it comes to using state money for schools, I think a lot of people know I'm a big believer in school choice. Whatever we do, we have to make sure we're not harming public schools, right? We're not just removing funds out of those schools, and we understand that as we move money around, what the pros and cons of those effects might be. I do have concerns when you start using state funds, whether it be a voucher program or, you know, all the different terms that you want to put for it, to schools of a non-public nature. Whatever we do, we have to take things stepwise. I think that's the most important thing. You don't want to jump into everything all at once. So some of the ideas that that I like and that I've seen and I've encouraged on the table are opening it up just within a program that allows flexibility within public schools, whether it just be for certain grades or, you know, maybe for entire districts if the districts were small enough and compact enough. So I think the point is that you don't want to jump in too big too fast. You have to understand what the repercussions to the public school systems might be, and make sure that you're doing it stepwise so you understand the pros, cons, negative effects, unintended consequences of any program you put forward in the state.
All right. That was Governor Sununu speaking this week. Do it stepwise, he says, which is interesting because he had made school choice and changing education, you know, a big priority on his campaign. You both are, you know, have sort of slightly furrowed brow hearing that tape, Kathleen and David.
Yeah,
what do you make of it?
I think it's interesting. He says you don't want to jump into this all at once. But if you look at the Education Freedom Savings Account bill that has made it through the Senate and is now in the House, that is a major, I mean, that's not stepwise. That is, would be, if you look at some of the reporting that's been done on this, one of the most sweeping voucher programs in the nation. I mean, it would open up a lot of states. Their voucher programs are dedicated to students that might be low income. I mean, this bill basically says any kid that's in public school now could be eligible for one of these grants, and they could use it not just to go to a private school. They could use it for homeschooling. They could use it for tutoring expenses. You'd basically get this scholarship that is the per pupil education, so somewhat around, what, $3,500 bucks to do what you wish. And that is, you know, Arizona recently signed something similar, but as far as, you know, they want to say it's not a voucher program, but it's basically a voucher program. And as far as that goes, it would be very, very sweeping. You know, and you can argue the merits for or against that, but to hear the governor say, well, some of the plans I've seen are a little bit more step by step, but to see the main plan that's going through is not step by step, I'm not sure exactly what he means, where his comments are coming
from.
I'm
not sure, Kathleen or Dave, maybe you know, the current version, does it or does it not include parochial schools on the list? Because the religious test is where you're going to always run into trouble with the courts.
The Senate version that's come over to the House and that the House is considering right now, does not contain any exclusion for religious schools. It intentionally does not contain an exclusion for religious schools.
Well, that will be challenged
in the courts, I'm sure. In fact, the supporters of the bill, its sponsor, Senator Reagan and others, hosted a big event at a building near the State House yesterday where they argued that there's no legal reason it can't include religious schools, which, of course, is going to be argued and debated very heavily. I was very surprised by the governor's comments that just played on tape, where he said he was concerned that it might be taking money to non-public from the public schools to non-public schools. And I asked him, you mean religious schools? And he said, I mean any non-public school. Which
is certainly quite a change between the sort of follow the student kind of rhetoric, you know, we've heard about and pathways, which is something he likes to say. But I mean, do you think he was just sort of treading water there, or do you think that suggests real?
I think there's a realignment of position that's taking place here in the face of a looming reality that this voucher bill is going to go down in the House. At least there's every indication that the House Education Committee on Tuesday is going to retain the bill because chairman of that committee, Rick Ladd, says they have big concerns about it, foremost among which is the fact that there is no exclusion for state money to religious schools, which is explicitly forbidden in the state constitution.
Kathleen?
Well, I also think it just raises the question again. I mean, one of the ongoing questions with Sununu is how engaged he is with the legislative process and what is happening with a variety of bills. It's very hard to ever get kind of a concrete answer out of their office on how they feel about legislation. And I think, again, to hear him say that he's, seen some more kind of piecemeal step-by-step approaches and to not really directly offer comment on what is the major school choice bill that is moving through, you wonder, is he treading water or are they not following these? Are they not sure where this is at? I mean, it's just that answer seems totally disconnected from the major bill that is working its way through the State House, and I don't know where that's coming from.
All right, tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr. We have a couple of emails, one from Luke in Concord. Isn't New Hampshire consistently ranked as one of the top states in the country for pre-K-12 education? Why is it a top priority for Sununu and Edelwood to shake up the system that will most negatively affect K-12 public schools? Another email from Diana, New Hampshire History, demonstrates it's a bad idea, this kind of power grab. This is going back a bit. She cites Terry Morton was given it 20 years ago at Health and Human Services, cost taxpayers money, many others demoted, one committed suicide. All right, let's go to the phones. Kathleen's on the line from Keene. Kathleen, good morning. Go right ahead. Or Catherine, sorry. I'm confused. I'm looking at Kathleen. Go ahead.
That's okay. Good morning. I just want to agree with all the opposition that's been brought up already to this bill for school choice and vouchers. But I would also like to add one point, and that is that it does not serve the lower socioeconomic people in our community. They cannot bus their children to another town for school in the morning. They don't have the means necessary to do that. They don't have the extra money to put towards a voucher to attend a private school that might cost $7,000 when they're only getting three from the state. So, and these
some people make the argument that, this is a familiar argument. Some people on the other side of this make the case that, some schools have, generous financial aid and that, the tax credit scholarship program that already exists, they have numbers suggesting that it's not simply the well-heeled that are benefiting by this. You don't think that that's – you don't buy that?
No, I don't buy that. I work down in Massachusetts where there is school choice, and so I have plenty of poor families that I work with who would like to take advantage of that because of the schools that they have to attend are pretty poor. But they aren't able to. They don't have a car to get their kids to the school in the next district. They don't have the money to put towards a voucher to send their kids to a private school, not to mention a religious school. I'm against that entirely.
All right, Catherine, thank you for calling. We have another email on the education issue, and this is from Robin in Lebanon, who says, really did not want to get into the kindergarten issue, but you and the governor keep stirring the pot. There are many studies on this. They're all nearly unanimous in concluding that there's no lasting effect on student achievement, that it all fades out after 2 or 3 years. The governor is just wrong. He may be winning votes, but he's still wrong. So says Robin in Lebanon. And, you know, this is one of the questions is, what is the debate about? Is it about, you know, student achievement? Is it about, you know, there are studies that just long-term benefits going to kindergarten as well that people were citing at the hearing. Is this about creating a seedbed for a workforce? Is it fighting opioids? Is it all of the above? Is it a fact that New Hampshire, as the governor says, is, you know, is an outlier on this issue at this point, and according to him, kind of being made fun of in Quebec?
He doesn't want to be the governor of the only state that doesn't have full-day kindergarten, sometimes it seems, is the underlying argument, because the empirical data can be argued both ways. There are studies that argue that it helps. There are the opponents bring forth their studies to the contrary. The governor's position is, why are we, if this is so bad, why do 49 states have it?
All right. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. You know, we've been talking a lot about education, but this is a very busy time of the year in the legislature on a lot of topics, you know, but some high-profile bills have been resolved. Senate Bill 7, which aimed to tighten food stamp eligibility, has been retained by a House committee, which is, you know, essentially a polite death for that bill. You know, testimony by Terry Smith, who's in charge of New Hampshire's public assistance program, really seemed to doom that bill. The testimony is a bit dry, but why don't we take a quick listen?
We can state that empirically, New Hampshire's fraud is 1% or less. A second misperception surrounding this bill is that it puts broad work requirements on food stamp recipients. In truth, what the bill does is touch on a small subset of food stamp recipients, that is childless adults aged 18 to 50.
All right, why don't we talk a little bit about what this bill hoped to do and, you know, why it failed. This bill seemingly kind of became an accidental priority of Senate Republicans for a time. It was sponsored by Senator Kevin Avard. It aimed to, you know, crimp requirements on TANF and, you know, add work requirement. You know, yeah. David, why did this become so heated?
There's a national effort underway to shrink the size of the food stamp program, largely on the ideological argument that too many people are reliant on government and need to be made more independent. This is sort of a template legislation that is being floated in a lot of state houses with Republican majorities. And the argument that, well, it's federal money. Why do we want to turn it away for people, a large majority of whom may need it? The argument being simply, well, we're all federal taxpayers and we need to guide these people off of government support and into independent living. But the reality on the ground in New Hampshire, with a very low poverty rate, a very high level of employment, that at a per capita basis, it has a fairly small food stamp population and a very low rate of fraud. And there was no sense of urgency about this. And there was a great opposition to it. It would basically have made it difficult to it would have shrunk the population in the state that would have been eligible to even apply for the program. When people hear things like you could now qualify for food stamps at 185% of the federal poverty level, and all we want to do is bring it down to 135%, to a lot of people that might sound reasonable, but there is some small print involved in that argument that we can discuss after the break.
All right, coming up, more Granite State headlines on the Exchange's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Stick around.
It's not a reaction that can necessarily control. I guess I'd call it the ick factor.
Yeah. This week on Something Wild, prepare for the heebie-jeebies.
Garter snakes are more cold-tolerant than most snake species, and they actually can freeze for short periods of time. But if that freezing is an extended period of time, they actually will die. Winter mortality can be fairly high for garter snakes.
Chris Martin has the 411 on our slithering neighbors. Subscribe to NHPR's Something Wild, wherever you get your podcasts.
Boy, cool stuff.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Joined this week by David Solomon, New Hampshire Union Leader Kathleen Ronay, Associated Press, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Why don't we go to the phones? Justin's on the line from Newmarket. Go ahead, Justin.
Hi. I just wanted to bring a couple of these issues back together. With the kindergarten, we're talking about it. We're the only state that doesn't have full-day kindergarten. We want to bring new businesses into the state, and we have a 2.8 unemployment rate right now. We need a workforce. We need to know who the skilled laborers are going to be, who's going to be filling these positions. So we need to attract people. So
all right, you sound a lot like Governor Sununu, Justin. Do you have a family? Do you have, how old are you? I'm curious. This is often become a generational fight.
I'm actually 29 right now.
All right.
So I don't have a family at the moment, but it would be something that in the future, it would be easier for me to hold down a job if I knew full-day kindergarten was available at that point.
All right, Justin, thanks for calling. Obviously, that's an argument that Governor Sununu and others have been making about just the lifestyle realities of, it's hard for families to survive on one income. People need to work. This could boost our economy and attract the right sort of workers, so say proponents. Why don't we move on to another issue before the House that is a very familiar one, been around long. Well, certainly, I don't know if you were to lay it next to kindergarten, how long this debate, but it certainly feels like it's been around forever, which is, of course, a debate on legalized gambling in New Hampshire. And, is it a death blow what happened in the Ways and Means Committee yesterday, 19-1 vote killing the casino bill passed by the Senate?
It would seem to be. I mean, you never know, right? The House is unpredictable. But in the past,
I mean permanently.
Casino bills have come out of Ways and Means before with close votes, right? Like, they've come out 10-11 or, I don't know, 9-11, whatever the amount is. And so to see it 19-1, I would be curious if that has ever happened out of House Ways and Means.
I mean, David, how much do you think this is about with Rockingham Park?
What we heard throughout the debate. This ship has sailed. I mean, the closest the state came, the moment was during Governor Haston's first term when she included the gambling revenue in her budget. Her party controlled the House. You knew you were going to get support in the Senate. It failed by one vote in the House. That was the moment, and the moment was lost. And since then, our neighboring states have established casinos in Maine and Massachusetts. The most logical location for one, Rockingham Park, is now no longer available. State Senator Lou D'Alessandro, who has made this a quest throughout his lengthy legislative career, I think figured he'd give it one last shot. And I have to believe this is the last shot.
I mean, even he told me before he was giving it a last shot. I don't think he's going to stop.
I think that he is going to be introducing casino bills as long as he is in the state Senate. Yeah.
We'll see.
And the issue is you really need, as you mentioned, Dave, you really need a governor to partner with on something like this because it takes a tremendous – given how controversial it is, it takes a tremendous amount of political capital to drive something like this. And I think that's what Governor Haston did in that first budget with $80 million. I mean, that's an example of how you might do it. And it did feel like that was kind of a moment. And I think you're also right that the environment around New Hampshire has changed dramatically in the last 10 or 20 years in terms of the options available to people. So, I think we're going to keep seeing that issue. We'll keep seeing Keno. But the reality is, I think it's going to be very, very difficult to sell.
Well, does this vote? I mean, the last few years, it's been, the House is leery of full bore casinos. It likes to expand gambling on the margins. The Senate believes that will leech momentum away from the casino that at least some in the Senate want deeply. Senator Morse, Senator D'Alessandro. They kill Keno and lottery expansions for that reason. I mean, are we going to see that again after this bill goes down?
I mean, I would be surprised if the Senate's never liked Keno. I'd be surprised if they put it in their budget. And now it's not like they have to take it out of the House budget. They would have to put it in. And so, maybe if it was in the House budget, they'd say, okay, this time around, maybe we'll leave it. But I don't know that I see them actively, putting Keno into their budget. The Senate has historically been pretty anti-Keno.
But we are seeing an expansion of gambling in the state among the charitable locations, these so-called gaming rooms, card rooms, they're growing. They're doing quite well. And so if you want to do blackjack or slots in New Hampshire, there are options to do it. And these the charities that benefit from these locations have been one of the strongest forces in opposition to gambling.
Well, and there is potentially more gambling on the gambling of a sort on the horizon. Fantasy sports seems like that's going to become likely to become law in New Hampshire. You know, what's at stake in that bill, Kathleen? I believe you wrote about this.
So, yeah, I mean, the deal here is you have these two companies, DraftKings and FanDuel, that they run mostly, I think, daily fantasy sports. And they have faced opposition in – there's been a debate nationwide sort of, is this like sports betting? Is this actually gambling? Or is this more of like a game of skill, right? And if so, to what extent does it need to be
regulated?
And the
regulated? Way this works is players draft from essentially a pool of real-life athletes, create these composite teams, and then based on how – those players perform in real life games, they
right.
can create
and,
points that then lead to.
And the idea is that people say, you know, it's not just a bet based on luck, you know, it's skill. You're supposed to look at the player's statistics and build what you think is the best team. And so they're saying it's, you know, different than maybe traditional sports betting. But these games have faced opposition in some other states where people have, you know, in New York State, the attorney general basically said this could be illegal gambling. And it was shut down for a little while until the legislature passed a bill saying, OK, we're going to regulate it. So DraftKings and FanDuel, the two major companies, they're actually OK with this regulation.
Well, it seems like sort of a don't fight the law, write the law kind of
yes,
approach.
Yes. If, OK. If we codify this in law that we are allowed to operate. And I mean, in New Hampshire, it would be up to a $5,000 annual fee and a 5% tax. New York, you're looking at an annual $50,000 fee and a 15% tax.
Well,
it's very low.
I was just kind of like Googling around a little bit on this topic. And it's very interesting. I mean, just this month alone, the number of states in which this debate is taking place, you know, Oregon, Ohio, Arkansas, Texas, New Jersey,
yeah,
Alabama.
Yeah, because the companies want it. They see it as this way, okay, we'll just get regulated and then we're not going to get shut down and we'll do it early while people – while this is still a growing industry. And if you're a player, I mean, this is going to have no material. If you're in a state that adds this regulation, you're not going to be taxed on your winnings or something. The company's going to be taxed. So, and, you know, lawmakers always, as we say, you know, they're hunting for money in whatever form of expanded gambling they can. And some of them are saying, hey, eventually, if this gets big enough, we might actually make a couple million bucks off this.
But, I mean, right now, the estimates from the Lottery Commission are – you know, maybe a couple hundred thousand dollars.
Yeah, indiscriminate.
Yeah, I mean, this has become a really big business. I mean, fantasy sports have been around for a long time. They started kind of organically, and they've been aided by the web. But you know, increasingly, it's becoming a real driver for things like the NFL and Major League Baseball. So it's a big business, and this has, as you mentioned, this has been a debate around the country. But it's my sense is it's going to keep growing, and if you have a couple hundred thousand people in the state who are involved in this, there is certainly an opportunity, as you mentioned, Kathleen, to get in early and kind of define how this is going to be regulated.
Why don't we go to the phones? David is on the line from Keene. Good morning, David. Go ahead.
Hi. I don't know if any of y'all were at SB3 this week, but I testified, and I'm hoping that sinks SB3's ship, but I don't know what y'all think is going to happen.
So what? So you favor the bill? You oppose the bill? Which side?
I oppose it.
Okay. All right, David. Thank you. So SB3 is a big bill working its way through the legislature. It's a bill that looks to require voters provide more proof of their domicile status. I dipped into that hearing. It was in the reps hall. Obviously, a lot of people there. Were you there, Kathleen?
Yeah, I went for a little while.
I mean, is there anything changing on this?
No, I think, you know, there was basically a day-long hearing when this went through the Senate. Now we're in the House process. I think we're hearing a lot of similar arguments. I mean, the main argument, obviously, from supporters is that this is a way to ensure only people that actually live here are voting here. Opponents, they're raising questions about all of the ways having – all of the populations that might be hurt by this new documentation that you have to provide. There was an interesting exchange between Representative Andy White and Bill Gardner about what it would mean for homeless voters who don't have a fixed address, maybe don't have an ID. And so I think, you know, we see opponents kind of trying to poke holes in all of the different groups, you know, show that this could have an effect on a variety of different groups, but there seems to be a lot of momentum behind this.
I mean, is there any sense that some of the questions of local election workers on this, I mean, oftentimes, you know, clerks, moderators, they're close to members in the House in particular, that they can be persuasive. Is there any sense that some of the reservations from them is making any difference, or this is just a straight partisan vote?
No, I spoke to the attorney for the New Hampshire Municipal Association yesterday, and this is another issue that is putting the election officials on the ground level, the town clerks and the moderators, again, at odds with the Secretary of State. Their relationship is very tenuous right now. There's a lot of bad blood over what happened with the rescheduling of the elections in the blizzard, and we may get to that. And now they're concerned that all of the requirements for voter verification that are being pushed down to the level of voter supervisors of the checklist is very troubling to them. The notion that they're going to have to deploy people to households to verify that these affidavits represent your true address, it puts them in a very uncomfortable position. And given the disagreement on these election reform bills and the disagreement over how the rescheduling of the elections were handled in March, the relationships between the town clerks and local election officials and the Secretary of State are very frayed.
There are
right
a couple
now.
Issues here. And the first one is the Secretary of State has said, and some people find this problematic, that there is no evidence of systemic or widespread fraud in the state, but there's a perception of it. So in a sense, we're legislating changes based on a perception rather than a reality, and that's been one of the criticisms. The other issue is for the Republicans that it's a little precarious because the optics on this politically could end up being that, you know, Republicans don't want college students to vote, that they're essentially they're one of the effects of these rules is that it's going to be very difficult if you're a college student from another state to vote in New Hampshire. You know, I know the Exchange did a show on this recently, and there was a very interesting discussion about, you know, if you live in a dorm, you have to have proof that you live in the dorm. But most kids get their mail at a P.O. box in a central facility. So then you have to get a letter from the university. And that, you know, a lot of students are just going to say it's not, you know, maybe they don't want to go through that effort or be discouraged. So that's dangerous.
I mean, there are also some, you know, conservatives who believe that this bill doesn't go far enough.
Sure.
I mean, is there any
we've heard the two extremes. I mean, on one end, you have the belief that you as an American citizen should get to vote where you are on election day as long as you don't vote anywhere else, period. And then there's this other extreme that we heard articulated at the hearings by former Senate President Clegg that, no, you should be a member of the community. You should be paying
property owner, basically,
community. I mean, that goes back to, you know, colonial days.
I mean, it may have sounded like Senator Clegg was Senate President. He was, in fact, majority leader.
House majority.
But he did make that point loud and clear. And, you know, something's going to happen on this bill, and I guess we'll find out whether the implications of it are, you know, as grave or as minimal as both sides.
Well, I also thought what was interesting is it was either Bill Gardner or Dave Scanlon, so someone from the Secretary of State, I think it was Gardner, saying, well, you know, there was hysteria over the voter ID law that we passed in 2012, and I said, oh, it's nothing to worry about, and I was right then, so you should listen to me now, was basically the argument that he made, which people on the other side, you know, might have plenty to say about voter ID, but basically his argument that it did not depress turnout, and saying, you know, I had the foresight to know that, so you trust me here.
Well, the infallibility of Bill Gardner has been hotly debated recently, but one point at which, you know, Dave, you alluded to it, where there was some agreement and movement and resolution was on the fix to deal with the postponed town meeting elections.
Yeah,
just quickly, mm-hmm. It's not terribly exciting, but there is some significance to it. What happened?
Well, 80 towns, or let's say 80 jurisdictions that would schedule elections, towns, school districts, and so forth, decided to reschedule their election on the day of March 14th because of the blizzard that was bearing down on the state, and the Secretary of State told them they couldn't do it. Their attorneys, their town attorneys, and the attorney for their association said they could do it. They did it, and it set the stage for about a month's worth of very fractious debate on how to resolve the legality of votes that were taken on any day.
What was the implication of not resolving
this? The biggest implication was that towns that passed bond issues to finance new libraries, school construction, or what have you, would not be able to get those bonds floated in the bond market because of fear that the outcome of the vote could be challenged, given the disagreement within the state about whether those votes were legal. So the legislature needed to come up with a solution. The initial proposal supported by the Secretary of State was to force these towns to have some other form of election all over again, which would have been very costly and set the stage for a small number of people overturning the decisions of those who did vote on whatever day.
So now, the bonds can go and... Yeah.
Well, they came up with a new solution yesterday, which is that select board or governing board of the body needs to simply hold a public hearing at which the public can come and testify as to whether the results of the election should be ratified or not. And after hearing the public, if the board of selectmen say, we now vote to ratify the results of the election held on May 21st, then those results are legally ratified. And that passed both chambers yesterday and will be signed by the governor. Everybody's quite sure.
All right. And the sort of festering ill will between, some of the state house and the municipal association, which had recommended that towns did have the authority. Like the issue about whether moderators have the authority to move elections, that remains unresolved.
Remains unresolved. Yeah. In fact, the Secretary of State's acts that he's been grinding against the New Hampshire Municipal Association and the clerks is written right into the bill that solves the problem. It says you can solve it on this day, but this does not mean you can do this in the future, and it does not mean that anybody who gave you legal advice that said you could do it is absolved of any liability.
All right. We'll leave it at the State House there. We've only got a few minutes left, but I do want to touch on, one thing that in the wake of Donald Trump's election was like, are there going to be any people from New Hampshire who are delivered some sort of plum government post? Frank Gindo has talked about for being drug czar, went to another fellow. Scott Brown looks like he's going to be headed to New Zealand as an ambassador. Interestingly, in President Trump's announcement of this, he identified him as being from Massachusetts, and I don't know whether that was an error or whether Scott Brown is no longer in Rye. Does anyone know? I mean, I'm assuming he's still in
Rye. I don't know, but I think that New Hampshire Democrats had quite a bit of fun with that one.
All right, so not much time left. What's everyone going to be focusing on in the near term?
Tuesday, the House Education Committee is going to exec on the voucher bill, and I predict it's going to be retained.
We're starting to get, outside of the State House, some big-name political figures coming back to New Hampshire next week. We have John Kasich and Joe Biden, and I think Martin O'Malley is coming this weekend as well.
Dean?
I'll be here next week filling in for Laura. We're going to talk New Hampshire politics, we're going to talk energy policy, and we're going to talk balance of power in Washington.
All right. Thanks for joining us. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. Have a good weekend, all.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.